Possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with theatrical performances of Arlene Hutton's As It Is in Heaven and Shakespeare's King Lear by the U of I Department of Theater, and Sarah Kane's Psychosis 4.48 by the Royal Court Theater of London. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
An estimated 40,900 new cases of primary brain tumors are expected to be diagnosed this year. This incident rate means that 14 out of 100,000 people will suffer from a primary brain tumor. There are more than 120 different types of brain tumors. Whether so-called benign or malignant, all can cause death or disability. Brain tumors are the leading cause of solid tumor cancer death in children and teens. Approximately 3,140 children younger than age 20 are diagnosed with primary brain tumors each year. Meningioma brain tumors, the most common type, affect twice as many women as men. Although termed benign, they are more deadly than breast cancer compared over a five-year period. My name is Maeve Riley, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. Today our topic is surviving brain tumors. Our guests are Dr. Raul Rodas, Director of Neuro-Oncology, Radiosurgery, and Functional Neurosurgery at the Central Illinois Neuroscience Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the advancement of neurological health care through education and research. Dr. Rodas completed medical school at Michigan State University, residency training in both neurology and neurosurgery, as well as advanced fellowship training in medical and surgical neuro-oncology, radiosurgery, stroke, and functional neurosurgery. He is one of 8 peer-selected members of the Scientific Advisory Committee for the National Brain Tumor Foundation based in San Francisco, California. Samantha Jane Scalamero is a 14-year survivor of an epidermoid cyst. She is the president and founding director of the Healing Exchange Brain Trust, an organization devoted to helping people communicate about brain tumors and related conditions via the Internet to promote a healing exchange of information and support. You can join our conversation by calling 333-9455. That's 333-WILL or toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Thank you, Samantha and Dr. Rodas, for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'd like to start with Dr. Rodas. You know, brain tumors were certainly mentioned quite a bit this summer in the news when the Tour de France was on, and because of Lance Armstrong and his incredible recovery from cancer and a metastatic brain tumor. I think I got that wrong. Could you discuss those kinds of brain tumors, the one that Lance Armstrong had, and how they differ from what we call primary brain tumors?
Oh, absolutely. Congratulations to Lance, of course, for championing not only the survivorship and the type of cancer that he had, but everything that he's done afterwards to increase the public awareness of not only of his particular type of cancer, but cancer in general. And, of course, for his spirits of what he was able to do with his sport. But the key is early diagnosis, and I think that there are some individuals out who do know that they have a risk factor, whether inherent from in family members known to have had some type of cancer, or that approaching an age, like a lot of us, who are aging in itself is a risk factor for developing a form of cancer, various parts of the body. Early diagnosis and awareness is a key factor in successfully treating these types of problems. And for Lance, you know, he had that ability and capability of getting treated effectively and quickly.
And his brain tumor, though, was transferred from a different side where he originally found cancer, right?
Absolutely. And in circumstances like that, the whole what we call biology of cancer is very, very, very special in that the originating cell or seed, if you will, where the cancer originates may be completely different by the time it finds a new home in a different organ system, being in the bone or the lung or in this particular case in the brain.
And I'm saying this wrong. Metastatic, is that correct?
Metastatic.
Okay, sorry. Brain tumors classified the same way as primary brain tumors. You know, I know we have four different grade levels for brain tumors, 1 to 4, with 4 being the most advanced. And there's many different tumor types. And do metastatic brain tumors fall under that?
Yes and no. I think that we are becoming more and more sophisticated in not only the diagnosis of these types of tumors, but the grading system, because a grading system is very important both in terms of prognosticating the to the patients and their families the survivability, but also having a direct bearing in the type of therapies that will be offered to these patients and their families as well. So that's evolving. Metastatic tumors, to not get too much into detail, but they're classified not only for their cell origin, their cell type, the size of the tumor, as well as the potential for metastasizing to the lymph nodes, to various other organ systems, as I mentioned, and to different structures as well. So all those factors play into a final staging, which is dramatically important in carrying information back to the family and offering prognosis, as I said, as well as therapies.
Okay, and I mentioned in the introduction that there are more than 120 different types of primary brain tumors. Do you see any types more commonly than others? And would there be any that are specific to Central Illinois in particular?
Very good question that can be answered in many ways. Oh. I think just because of the incidence being higher for lung cancers, for example, and prostate for both men and women, and breast cancer specifically, of course, for women. But also, it should be known that men can also develop a form of breast cancer just as well. But from a volume standpoint in incidence, the risk of lung cancer and prostate cancer is very high in those genders. And because of the volume, again, it has a propensity for metastasizing both early and late. So when a problem is suspected, it behooves both the patient and the clinician. The patient from the standpoint of asking the appropriate questions, and the clinicians from the standpoint of taking that extra step, an extra minute, to investigate the possibility of early metastasis. And generally, nowadays, that should be automatic.
Okay, and in terms of brain tumors, primary brain tumors, though, are there any that are more that occur more regularly? That are more?
Yes, they do. When specifically we talk about primary brain tumors, as you mentioned, Maeve, that there are fortunately benign and malignant types. And generally, when people think about this, they correct and to assume that the benign ones are the slow growing and the malignant ones are the rapidly growing. But the person can have a benign tumor that is located in an inaccessible area of the brain, meaning that you can't remove it, and where it would behave in a malignant form with the symptoms it produces and inaccessibility to treat it appropriately. And you can also have a malignant type of tumor that is readily accessible. You can remove it, but, you know, guess what? It comes back, and then it back again. And there's no formidable treatment for that type of problem. So the brain is a special organ, both in terms of what it represents, what you can do for the tumor in avoiding complications of therapy-related problems, as well as the opening of new directions and how to treat them. And we may have some time to spend with that a little later.
Okay. And how would a brain tumor present itself? I know people have said they've had headaches or perhaps seizures. I've heard one person say they had a seizure that was actually they were hearing music and that was a form of a seizure. So what might the symptoms be?
And you just mentioned the majority of the symptoms, but it really depends on the territory that this growth is taking place in. If you can think of the brain as a map of the United States, different states representing different functions within the brain. And I think from the awareness that certainly we've gotten on TV, both from medical programs and just straight entertainment programs, you kind of get an idea that that the brain is segregated into different functional areas. For example, you mentioned that the one somewhat strange instance of hearing music as a presentation. There is, as we know, in the temporal lobe, for example, and in certain parts of the frontal lobe, that the person can have irritative focuses from a growth, and that can lead into an abnormal activation of nerve cells, which then again can lead into a seizure, kind of like a ripple effect. And again, depending on the region, but there is a musical representation, if you will, in the temporofrontal lobe connections, where if the focus is there, a person can have those types of sensations, and in this case, internal musical interpretation of an irritation related to nerve.
And if someone came to you and said they had this kind of symptom, what would be the next step? How would you diagnose what they have?
Well, unfortunately, by the time they see me, things are pretty kind of much in the open. But I think the more common is that when a patient is having a headache that they haven't been accustomed to before, if they're not a headachey type of person, or if they are a headachey person, there is this pattern of a new type of headache that's either stronger, lasting longer, just takes on a different type of character and pattern that they've been accustomed to, or they can have a seizure, just as you've mentioned. But these sorts of symptoms gets recognized, and nowadays it's just a reflex action to obtain a CAT scan or an MRI scan, and which can easily detail the tumor and the growth. Now, having just said that, there is still a substantial number of patients that come in with a completely unrelated type of presentation. Maybe they had a sports injury, or they had a problem with vague memory, or they've had something completely unrelated, as I'm saying. And it comes out in the physical examination or in the history taking that there is something out of the ordinary, where by that suspicion, a CAT scan or an MRI scan is obtained, and they're diagnosed with something that they never knew they even had.
Okay. I'm going to reintroduce our guests here, and then I'm going to bring Samantha into our discussion. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking with Dr. Raul Rodas, a neurosurgeon and neurologist, and Samantha Jane Scalamaro, a survivor of an epidermoid cyst and president and founding director of the Healing Exchange Brain Trust. You can join our conversation about brain tumors by calling 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, or toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Samantha, can you join us now?
And I would love to.
Okay, great. And could you share your story a little bit with us, please?
Yeah, I will. Well, for one thing, I wanted to respond to the conversation about types of brain tumors, and you were speaking about the kind that Lance Armstrong had, which was a metastatic tumor that moved from his original site of cancer to the brain, and his remarkable recovery from that. And then the difference between that and a primary brain tumor, which originates in the brain, and those being distinguished between the more aggressive malignant types and then the slower growing non-malignant types. And the term benign brain tumor has been thrown around a little bit, and from the layperson's perspective, that can be a very comforting word to hear. But also, the doctor suggested, that if the tumor is located in a difficult spot or something, it could, it's like real estate, location, 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 as to the what types of effects it might exert on the brain. I'd also like to say, though, that in the patient world, we're trying to move away from the word benign brain tumor, because in many folks' experience of it, that term is misleading. When you look up benign in the dictionary, it says harmless. Mm-hmm. And the term benign brain tumor is almost an oxymoron. Now, granted, from a clinical point of view and looking at the histology and the behavior of those cells, the benign cells are not as aggressive, not as invasive, versus the malignant ones, which are much more so. But people are lulled into a false sense of, like, oh, everything's fine, just because it's benign, and many benign brain tumors can have other effects and residual effects that can be quite difficult and very subtle, and make the survivorship process more difficult, because they've been told that it's nothing to worry about.
Right. And I know you are quite interested in acquired brain injury, which I think kind of goes along with what you're saying with benign tumors and the effects that they can have.
Absolutely. And folks who have either a benign or a malignant brain tumor may have the effects of brain injury with the result of their tumor. Simply the existence of the tumor, the mass effect of the tumor, may cause different types of damage to the brain itself, to the structures within the brain, And then there is the subsequent treatment, whether it's surgery, chemotherapy, or radiation, in trying to, quote-unquote, cure the tumor. There is, you know, there is other damage that can happen to the, all that is absolutely tried to be minimized by the healthcare professionals, the surgeons, the neuro-oncologists, and so on. But there's still the fact that having a tumor in one's brain, whether it's no matter how aggressive it is, it can have a significant impact on the brain.
Okay, and I would like to come back to that in a little while, but I would like you to tell your story about how you were diagnosed.
And sure. And it will explain a little bit about why semantics are especially important to me as well.
Right.
I had a very bad toothache that lasted for a number of years, and I kept being misdiagnosed. And finally, my family dentist was on vacation, and I went to a dentist where I was working at MIT, and he said, I don't know what this is, but this is not a toothache. And I was referred to a specialist for trigeminal neuralgia, which was that type of facial pain. And I was told initially that I had multiple sclerosis, or could have it, and that they would do some tests to find that out. And I was ecstatic because I had been having these terrible headaches, such as Dr. Roden described. I was taking so much aspirin a day, it was like I was having to go to the pharmacy pretty regularly, which was very unusual. And when they came back and they said, well, I have good news, you don't have multiple sclerosis, there's this cystic lesion in your brain, and that's good because we can take that out. And so I really didn't know what to make of this information, other than there was this thing there, and it was at the base of my skull, and that was great because they could take it out. And when I finally pressed the neurosurgeon to say, okay, well, what's the difference between this epidermoid cyst thing and, like, a brain tumor, he said, well, it is one. Mm-hmm. Didn't they tell you? And so the semantics of that was very, based on the cell type, it might not fall under certain brain tumor classifications, but nevertheless, it's a mass, and Dr. Roden can talk more about it, a mass that was causing pressure on the brainstem. It was not composed of brain cells. It was other types of cells that were trapped there in the brain, but had quite a large impact on the brainstem and the surrounding structures. It took them 18 hours to remove the cyst from the cerebellopontine angle area of the brain, and it took quite a long time for me to recover from the surgery, but also some of the other residual effects that I have as a result of that. There's a lot of fatigue and some other challenges that are, impact my daily activities. And one of the important things, too, was that in my expression about the language is that when I, a couple years after the surgery, I still wasn't feeling back to my old self. I've been told I was cured to go back and have a regular life, and I was having challenges with reading, with standing up, with sensitivity to light and noise, cognitive and sensory overload, which are similar to symptoms that people have from mild traumatic brain injury, from post-concussive syndrome. Other people have been in a car accident or other types of injuries like that. And when I was trying to get back to my regular activities, I asked myself, well, who else has gone through this type of experience? And so I tried to find a brain tumor support group. And when I called them and told them my experience, and they said, well, they wouldn't let me join because I didn't have cancer. And I was really kind of devastated. And then I thought, well, okay, well, what's the next best thing? And then I looked to the head injury groups, and they said, well, but you had a brain tumor. You have your own group. And so I was kind of rejected from both sides, and I thought, oh, this is very strange. And I finally found a brain tumor support group. It was about 45 minutes away, so I need to take a whole day off from work to try and get there and go to that and then come back. And they didn't care what kind of tumor I had, and it was really neat that it was mixed, both benign and malignant. I wonder if the folks at the big city hospital were concerned that there was, a mix of, I was 2 years post-surgery, and a lot of their people were really in crisis going through the treatment in the hospital, mm-hmm, right then, and going through surgery and dealing with perhaps very different situation. But I learned a great deal from my experience at the group that was mixed with a range of tumors from, you know, the benign, quote-unquote, but so-called benign, low-grade tumors all the way up to the very aggressive glioblastoma tumors. And there's such a range of experience. And the common thing that we share, though, is this alteration of our brain because of this sort of invading tumor.
Right.
And having something in there is not a pleasant experience for anybody.
That's right. And Dr. Otis, I wonder if you would like to comment a little on that.
Oh, absolutely. It was a very valid, important point that was made about the definition of what's benign and malignant. And for practical purposes in my practice, and I specialize in brain tumors, if you will, I never use that word.
Yeah.
And I tell families, even though that's what I do, I feel uncomfortable, and I rather use the word growth, because
yeah.
growth has more of a functional meaning for both them and myself. You know, you have this growth of abnormal cells, and this is what it means, and this is what it represents, is what we're going to try and do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the long and the short run, it just transforms into a more accepting type of discussion. And as you well know, there are various stages of acceptance of whatever disease process a person may have, you know, and with that process, you know, it evolves into a recognition, it evolves into a denial, it evolves into acceptance in the various stages.
Absolutely. And,
yeah.
and having a Dr. Roden, too, I'm sure you'll agree that, but not and others who have, having a brain tumor is definitely a growth experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have to remain, to have some type of sense of humor in dealing with these things, because it really is a challenge.
Now, I'd like to bring a caller in, and I'd like to thank the caller from Indiana on line 4 for their patience. And please go ahead.
Hello. I'm hoping that you can give some information from this question that I can't give you everything. It's more than anecdotal, but a fellow worker, a lady's daughter, who's approximately 13, has a tumor, and it's never been called cancerous, in the bottom center of the brain. It's causing incredible amounts of pressure. Now, the quick history was that she was complaining of a jaw ache, and a dentist, her normal dentist, did an X-ray, discovered a mass, and turned out to be a tumor. And they removed that, and I guess it did a lot of damage to the bone structure of the jaw and made it very porous, so they had to be very careful about her, you know, being hit by something. So they took her out of volleyball and things like that. A number of months later, less than 6, she started complaining of severe headaches and went to the emergency room a number of times, and they sent her to the what's called Riley's Children's Hospital in Indiana, in Indianapolis, and it came back that she had this tumor. It's been very difficult for the rest of us at work to approach the mother, try to get some information. All I know is that the 2 times she talked to me, that the doctor said there was nothing was, you know, 50-50. All it was against the little girl. And if they go in one way and try to remove it, they'll cause her to have paralyze her nerves for her face on one side. And in the other way, that they would have to do something, I guess, with the optic nerve, because she would end up being blind. And I just wonder, from this information I've given you, whether you can make any sort of, you know, generalization that would be sensible. Thanks a lot.
Dr. Rodas?
Well, as Maeve said in the earlier part of the program, that children in general, a high incidence of primary brain tumors, second leading cause of death in that population, unfortunately. And the fact that she was diagnosed when she was a little bit older, as an adolescent more so, kind of adds some information that's both positive and negative. I think, as you know, as we brought out, that location has an enormous effect on not only what you can do, but how effective the treatment that you're offering. Treatments are changing. As I said earlier, they are evolving, and we are starting to make use of tremendous technology that has come forth from neural imaging. Basically, what CT scans or MRIs were of the yesterday, they're becoming totally different technologies now and in the future, where we are able now to not only image the location of these type of tumors, that really go into the chemical makeup of some of these tumors. Now we can map out the chemical fingerprint without even having to make an incision on a person's scalp. And the way that we do that is an item that's called MR spectroscopy. They use spectroscopy in the physics lab for a number of experimental and very applicable commercial type of applications as well. But for these tumors, you know, the chemical makeup can be looked at, and that information can be directly carried over to give the patient and the family some recognition of whether this growth is a slow-growing process or a quick-growing process. Now, depending on that type of setting, then they can move on to either doing a direct biopsy, again, depending on the location, and then from the biopsy, work even more forward to developing tumor markers that can carry both prognosis as well as possible treatment options. And with those last two statements, they're very heavily weighted statements that with some of the members in the audience who may have some background in some of the emerging technologies, tumor receptors is something that is currently in the forefront, not only for brain tumors, but for very well known for breast cancer and lung cancer, prostate cancer. A lot of the current therapies right now is exactly based on that, and it is recognizing that each and different type of tumors do have these special little antennas and receptors that respond favorably to manipulated hormonal types of agents, if you will. And that's only one example of the many different types of newer developments in these tumors. So, but not to get too further away from your anecdotal situation from this little girl, I think that once you've ascertained whether this is a faster-growing tumor and hopefully been able to biopsy it, you can offer this this patient more directed and focused type of therapies. Now, having just said that, there are situations where even though you have therapy, you just can't make it available for these patients because of the dread of causing new symptoms, just as it was mentioned earlier. I currently have an active in a case of a young girl who I've been following for the last 5 years who presented with headaches, and she had a hydrocephalus type of condition, which is a condition where the normal draining pathways of the cerebrospinal fluid in our brains are blocked. And specifically, there's this one pathway that's about as the diameter of a coffee stirrer stick. The center of the stick, of course, has a little hole. And if you peek inside that little hole, that's about the diameter of this pathway that was being blocked by the growth of her tumor. I biopsied it, made a determination about what it was, and I went through the steps that I've just described, treated the hydrocephalus by putting a shunt on her, and she was able, because the symptoms, her symptoms were being caused by the hydrocephalus, she was able to resume a 100% normal activity as a kid would that was in junior high. At the meantime, you know, she had seen, I had sent all the information to the top three cancer centers in the country, and each different cancer center came out with completely different recommendations. My suggestion to the patient and the family was just do nothing. The shunt was treating her symptoms. This growth was slow growing, and fortunately it allowed this person 5 years of good quality type of lifestyle. Where we're at right now is that this growth is progressing, and now we're actively choosing to treat her with a form of chemotherapy and then offer her some form of very focused radiation therapy. But the whole basis of elaborating this particular discussion in this way is that you really do have to look at the patient, the family situation, and tailor their therapies, because that's an individual that you're treating. Is singled out from statistics, but you know, you really are affecting the life of this individual. And for many of you in the audience that are involved in this situation, if you don't feel that you are getting that individualized type of treatment, ask questions. Feel free to ask them. And if that's irritating the person that you're working with, choose another individual.
And Samantha, I think yep. The other part of that question may be unasked is this man is a coworker of the person that's involved in this. And what kind of support should he give to his coworker, or what can he advise her to do in terms of, I know you run an online support group.
So. Absolutely. We have the largest online support group network in the world, really. We have the biggest brain tumor support group going at www.braintrust.org. And people can contact us to get more information about that. One of the things that we do is we try to teach people to be self-advocates, and as the doctor suggested, to ask questions. One of the questions to ask, or one of the means of support that the caller could do, is sort of gathering, helping to gather information to approach the family member. And again, family members deal with these situations each differently, depending on their own experience and so on. But one of the questions to ask is of the physicians who said that there could be damage by doing an approach if they went one way or the other way, a very particular question to ask is that how many tumors in this same location have they operated on? Depending on their, even the region of the country or wherever they're located, a university hospital, for example, or a larger city hospital may have a physician who is very highly practiced at doing skull-based tumors, for example, whereas someone who sees fewer cases is going to have less experience doing skull-based tumors. I don't know the precise location of her tumor, but that's definitely a valid question to ask. You know, have you done 2 of these this year? Have you done 20 of these this year? So that's an important thing. And also to ask for a second opinion. Sometimes it requires going outside of the local region to get an opinion from another source about what some other physician's approach might be. So learning to be a self-advocate, learning to ask good questions, and finding out what the good questions to ask are. Talking to the family member about, you know, just asking how is she doing herself, and what kind of support does the parent need, because having, you know, a child who has a critical illness is quite overwhelming for the whole family. Oftentimes, I've been on both sides of the fence. I know one individual who is a brain tumor survivor, and his brother had thyroid cancer, which I believe was something that was more quote-unquote able to be had a higher cure rate than his tumor did, and he said that as a brain tumor patient with an aggressive adult medulloblastoma tumor, he felt more helpless being the family member of his brother with the thyroid cancer than he did. He felt it was easier to be the patient, and so supporting the caregivers is a critical piece of dealing with this as a family. So offering that that family member the opportunity to talk about it if they need to, and it sounds like the family has been sort of difficult to approach, or it's hard to know what to say, really.
And I would like to get in one more caller here from Urbana on line one. Go ahead, please. Urbana, line one.
This isn't too far afield. Have you had any experience with the shrinkage of tumors and growth masses in general by using various seaweeds? Perhaps some patients have touched on that, or if you've done any investigation or found any results. Curious.
Could you repeat that again? What kind of weeds were they?
It's seaweed.
Oh, seaweed. Okay.
Specifically, wakame, kind of a Japanese, and olaria. Apparently, they shrink tumors. I've had some mild success in that regard, but nothing in the way of a brain tumor as such. But I didn't know if you folks had done any research or had come across that and what information you might have on that.
Okay, I'll let Dr. Rodas go first here.
Well, I think that's a very important and appropriate question just as well, because there is a lot out there that Western medicine just does not know of. And it's a topic that really hasn't been opened up until a couple of years ago, when NIH is actually funding an enormous grant, with a grant being offered, an enormous study that is looking at non-traditional ways of treating cancer. Whether it's holistic or whether it's natural medicine, it's all encompassed in this non-traditional format. But there is a lot of substance, a lot of information that can be drawn out from various approaches that do not involve chemotherapy or radiation or surgery. I think the fault lies on the way that medical students are trained. They just don't get this type of training early on. And it's just like raising a child. If you don't expose them, the child to be open-minded and to investigate these other areas, it'll never get done, because for a doctor or a surgeon, once they get into their residency training and practice, it becomes very difficult to be open-minded that way. Sadly, to say that, but that's the truth. I do think that a lot of these natural products do harbor some anti cancer type of properties. But the real question is that how much and how do they work? And that's the type of thing that NIH is trying to investigate, because as patients and families try and look for non-traditional methods, you have to understand that some of these agents may also work against existing therapies, being that medications that are being used to treat nausea, for example, or headaches or other symptoms that can correlate with the patient's tumor. And the other issue is toxicity just as well, because, you know, taking 1 ounce of this seaweed, as you mentioned, versus 3 pounds of it a day does have a significant impact, but not only in terms of effectiveness, but also on toxicity.
Go ahead, Samantha.
I'd love to jump in. There's a person who was a member of one of our online groups who is also a PhD in nutrition, and she has, because of some personal involvement that she had with a brain tumor survivor with glioblastoma tumor, she got highly interested in nutritional therapies for brain tumors, and I believe that she is also working with the NIH and on doing some studies because she has come up with a regimen of vitamins and supplements for people with malignant and primary malignant brain tumors to consider, and has had some remarkable results, although those results have not been necessarily reviewed at this point, but it's and I know that she is working with, getting the research funded so that she can publish it as say, look here, this is the progress that we've made with, not necessarily pharmaceutical treatments. And her name is Jean Wallace, Wallace, and she's on the editorial board of Integrated Cancer Therapies and the International Journal of Integrative Medicine. And we could, or, you know, even just searching Jean Wallace on the internet, you could find her and get in touch with her. I believe that she's in Utah.
And Dr. Rodos, I wonder if you could talk about some of the more traditional the methods that are used now, as opposed to some of those.
Absolutely. I'll try to answer that question both in terms of primary tumors and metastatic tumors as well. When someone's diagnosed with a growth of the brain, and it is accessible, first and foremost, the best the treatment would be the surgical removal, because by removing the hopefully the complete resection of this type of tumor affords that patient that the other treatments to follow will have better efficacy and duration of efficacy than if you were to leave tumor behind. That's been very, very well proven both in the years past as well as very recently. That whole issue has been readdressed. So surgery, if you can have it, have it, and be as complete as possible the first time around. You've got to be aggressive the first time around. The second line therapy would be radiation therapy. Now, traditionally, radiation therapy is given as daily treatments. Again, depending on the area of the brain that's being affected, the doctors have pretty good equipment now to just be able to put a cloud of radiation, if you will, right over that tumor with a margin that will take care of the infiltrative cells that are around this tumor. And now I'm talking about invasive, aggressive type of tumors, not benign. And after the radiation therapy, again, depending on the cell type, chemotherapy can be offered following the radiation. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there are things that are evolving in the treatment of these tumors. And sometimes, especially so, if you're tailoring the treatment to that patient specifically, I may offer a form of chemotherapy before the radiation is started to shrink down the tumor cells and expose less of the normal brain to the side effects of the radiation, and or in very few cases, offer the chemotherapy even before surgery after the biopsy is gotten. And practical case in point is the lymphomas of the brain and the spinal cord where that would do. And in fact, surgery has now become not anything that's offered for lymphomas of the brain any longer, where chemotherapy comes up front, followed by radiation at the time of recurrence or for salvage therapy. But that would be the standard in that order: surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy. Now, having just said that, we are very quickly moving into new developments into every of those forms of therapy. We can now do surgery that affords a complete resection, a very focused resection, as well as increasing the safety of that resection where a patient may not have any new deficits apart from having the tumor create the deficit. And we have the technologies, and the best way to define some of these technologies is just like a GPS system in a car, for example, that navigates the where you're going in the highway. It navigates the surgeon to where he's going in the brain. We're doing that right now here locally. The other item that we do in surgery as well is implant chemotherapy directly into the brain. We implant radiation agents directly into the brain that are housed by a balloon, so we can begin the therapies immediately, right there at the time of surgery, and or complete 6 weeks of radiation within only 3 to 4 to 5 days. And what this transcends into a patient of this sort is that they're able to spend more time with their families and better quality of time. They're not sick from the therapies that you're giving them. And moving away further into the nuances of the radiation, we have devices now that are robotically driven called a CyberKnife that provides radio surgery in a fractionated way. These are terms that may be hard to comprehend, but again, they're available at the website. And again, these are approaches that are quickly evolving. One of the more exciting things that I'm currently working on that will be brought to our central Illinois area is the offering of immune therapy for primary brain tumors to be followed by stem cells and gene therapy. That's right in the cutting edge of things that will be, I'm hoping, that we coming more focused into the picture, if you will, after this election year.
And I do have to apologize. The caller from Urbana is still on the line and had a follow-up question. I apologize for that. So can we go back to line one, please?
Oh, yes. Thank you. I enjoyed the comments since as well, again, regarding seaweeds and so forth. I appreciated your comments, and you're very much openness in commenting on the history, medical students, and so forth, but thought I would throw out a title, which it might help somebody down the road, whatever, but the author is Paul Pitchford, and the book is Healing with Whole Foods, Oriental Traditions and Modern Nutrition, in which he goes through, you know, the seaweeds, and he does give, in answer to your question, he does give amounts of the various seaweeds that have been, I guess, traditionally found to be of benefit with regard to relieving symptoms. So I'll throw that out, and thank you very much for your comments.
Okay, thank you. And Samantha, we just have a few minutes left, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about braintrust.org and some of the services that you provide. I know one of your pushes is for brain tumor awareness, and you have some gray ribbons that you would be happy to send out
Absolutely.
To people.
Absolutely. Yep, anybody who would like free gray ribbons, they can call us at our 800 number. It's 1-877-252-8480, extension 1, and that's for free gray ribbons for brain tumor awareness. They come with information cards and include some of the facts that Maeve read earlier in the program about some facts and figures about brain tumors, and you can hand those out to friends, family, coworkers, just to help raise awareness about the problem of brain tumors. It's an invisible illness, and people who are living with them, you know, it's not something you can see. If you have a broken leg, you can see someone has that kind of problem, but something that's in the brain is really not visible, and we're trying to raise more awareness about the problem. We have been members of the North American Brain Tumor Coalition for Brain Tumor Action Week. We've led vigils on Capitol Hill just to raise awareness in the nation's capital. There are the other services that we provide are online support groups. We have a range of brain tumor types, from oligodendroglioma to craniopharyngioma to meningioma, a number of different groups. And there's also the big brain TMR list that covers all different types of brain tumors is more than 800 participants from all over the world. Just got an email today from a woman in Zaire who had found some of the information helpful and was looking for more information to distribute to some people that she knew in a clinic near them. So it's the internet is a remarkable tool for being able to connect with others, particularly since many tumor types, as you mentioned, there's more than 120 different kinds, are very rare. So we help people to connect with others who may have similar tumor types to themselves or who may be going through similar experiences. The website is www.braintrust.org, and we're getting ready to launch our new website shortly, so the old one's still up there, but we look forward to hearing from people. They can call us on the 800 number, which is the toll-free number, which is 877-252-8480, and extension 1 will get people some ribbons.
Okay, and I'm going to try to squeeze in one quick question here on line 1, please.
I'm calling about my 49-year-old sister-in-law who is just diagnosed with glioblastoma. Mm-hmm. She's in New Hampshire and is going to be connecting with other doctors, and choices would be Boston, Dartmouth, Portland, and wondered if you would have a doctor or a clinic recommended who's up on the cutting edge of the new gene therapy and stem cell stuff.
Go ahead, Doctor.
Certainly, you're in a good area. There's a lot of individuals very talented that are right around at the hand's reach from where you're at. Probably the Mass General program in Boston has a very comprehensive program that you can easily learn from. Several different names that I can throw out to you that would be certainly, you know, by contacting the Mass General Brain Tumor Program, they have a very elaborate both clinical and scientific portions that can provide good resources for both you and your relative.
And I'm sorry, Dr. Rose, I'm going to have to cut us off now, and I hate to do this. Our time is up. I'd like to thank Dr. Raul Rodas, neuro-oncologist and radiosurgeon, and Samantha Scalamero, a brain tumor survivor and founder of the Healing Exchange Brain Trust. Thank you both for joining us, and I hope we can continue this conversation again another time. Thanks also to Henry Frayne, our board operator, and Harriet Williamson, the executive producer of the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Maeve Riley, and joining us now is Todd Gleason. He is today's settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
You bet, Maeve. Thank you very much. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, futures across the grains floors finished the day lower. That on harvest pressure in both the corn and the soybeans, the wheat just taking a break after running up several sessions in a row on ideas that the Canadian crop just isn't there or was hurt fairly significantly by colder weather earlier in the season. Now let's begin with that wheat pit. December futures were down 9 for the day. They had a high at 335.5, a low at 325, and a settlement price at 325.75. Once again, that December contract down 9 cents. March futures in the wheat pit, 345.25, the high, the low at 336. Settlement price there at 337. They were off 8.25 for the day. And the May futures, 349, the high, the low at 340.5, settled 341.5, down 7.25. July futures for the wheat pit, 351, the high, the low at 344. Settled 345, down 5.5 cents for the day. From the corn pit, the nearby December contract, 213.25, the high, the low at 210 today. Settled 210.25, down 2.5 cents. March futures, 223.25, high, low at 220. Settled 220.5, down 2.25. And the May contract, a 229.75 high, the low and a settlement price, both at 227. That was down 2.25. July futures now, 235, the high, low at 232.75, a settlement price at 233, they were down 1.75. September futures, 240.25 high, low at 238.25, settlement price at 238.5, down 1.75. And next year's December corn, 247, the high, the low at 244.5, settlement price at 244.75, they were down 2.25 for the day. From the oat pit, the nearby December contract, 170.25, the high, the low at 164.5, settlement price at 166, down 4.5 cents, and the March oats, 173.5, the high, the low, and settlement price both at 170 for the March oat contract, down 4.25 cents. From the soy complex this afternoon, 545, the high for the nearby Novembers. The low at 535.75, settled 538.25. They were down 4. Januaries were off 3.25, as were the March and the May contracts. The January had a 552.5 high, a low at 543.5. They settled 3.25 lower at 546.25. March futures, 559.5 the high, low at 551. Settled there at 554, down 3.25, and the May beans were off 3.25 too. 566 the high, the low at 558.5. Settlement price for the May beans, 561. From the July contract in the bean pit, 571.5 the high, the low at 564.5. They settled at 566.5, off 4 cents. And next year's November, down a half cent for the day, 567 the high, the low at 563. Red November settled at 565.5. October bean meal, 160.50 the high, the low at 158.40. They settled at 159.40. They were down 50 cents for the day. And December bean meal, 162.80 the high, the low at 160.30. Settlement price at 161.70, off 60. October bean oil, 22.05 the high, the low at 21.60. Settled 21.78, down 9 cents for the day. And the December soybean oil finished unchanged. 21.92 the high, the low at 21.50. Settled 21.71. Once again, they were unchanged for the afternoon. Be sure to stick with us through the closing market report at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon. That program begins, and we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services about what happened at the Board of Trade and, of course, what happened at the Mercantile Exchange. Now, here with those numbers is Jay Pierce.
Thank you very much, Todd. The September feeder cattle had a high of 115.10 today, a low of 114.40, the settlement 114.70, and that was unchanged. October feeder, 113.40 was the high. The low, 111.70. The settlements, 112.45, down 7.5. November feeder, 112.40 for the high. 110.75 was the low. 111.30 was the settlement, down 10. Live cattle for October, that is, had a high today at 86.50, a low of 84.50. The settlement was 84.85, and that was down 80. And the December live cattle, the high today, 89.05, the low, 87.25, the settlement, 87.60, down 77.5. October lean hogs, the high, 74.55, the low, 73.40, settlement, 74.15, down 30. December, the high today, 69.65, the low, 68.70, the settlement, 69.42.5, down 15. February lean hogs, the high 67.80, the low 66.95, the settlement 67.65, down 40. And April, the high 65.70, the low 65.07.5, settlement 65.57.5, down 30. Frozen pork bellies for February, the high today 101.32.5, the low 99.87.5, the high 137.5, down 85. And that's a look at the Merc.
Thank you very much, Jay. Just a quick reminder, it's National Farm Safety and Health Week. If you're on a harvester this afternoon, take a little time to make sure that you've got everything organized. There have been at least 4 combine fires in one area of the state in the last week and a half, that over near Jacksonville. Make sure you've got something to put those fires out on board with you this afternoon. In just a few minutes, we'll take a look at the nation's forecast.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jason Fay from Regina, Canada writes, Dear Dr. Science, why does the water in the bathroom taste different than the water in the kitchen?